I'm going to call this meeting of the Government Operations Committee to order. Welcome, everybody. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes of the March 5th, 2020 meeting. Is there a member who would like to move approval of the minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The minutes are adopted. The first item on the agenda is House File 3584. I will move House File 34 be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. To the Agriculture Committee. So, Representative Lesh, would you like to present your bill?
Sure, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Back in 2007, I swore I would never carry another animal bill in the Minnesota House.
And that didn't go very well.
No, it's like I think every other year that I've had one. But the reason I do is because they're pretty important, and it's a area of law that all of our constituents care more and more about every year. Companion animals are a critical part of our lives. We consider them members of our families. And I will tell you, all of you should support this bill. Despite, you know, any concerns of what's this going to do, how this is going to impact other areas. Now, let me be clear. If you didn't cry when Old Yeller died, maybe you won't vote for the bill. But if you did, you absolutely are going to vote for the bill, okay? This establishes a companion animal board that will provide expertise in companion animal issues and will support the efforts of communities, citizens of Minnesota, and organizations in Minnesota that care for the animals. So the definition of the companion animal is already in existing law, which I had on my phone, but now I got to open to my face here. So it's a pet or companion animal, any animal owned, possessed, cared for, or controlled by a person for the present or future enjoyment of that person or as another as a pet or a companion or any stray pet or stray companion animal. So that's who we're talking about. We're talking about Ms. Rudolph's ducks. We're talking about little Fluffy, which I know Representative Nash, gets big dogs, okay. Lassie or Garfield the cat. Okay, we're not talking about sled dogs. We're not talking about, breeding, hunting dogs, any of that. The problem is that there's no place in state government to house companion animal issues. There's no specific expertise on companion animal issues. And currently, livestock falls under ag and wildlife falls under the DNR, and there's nothing set up for companion animals. And this is a growing area of law that we're seeing in the news every day. When someone wants to, you want to bring a pot-bellied pig on United Airlines or whatever, okay? I mean, how do you deal with that? What's going on? And a companion animal board is something that would deal with that when it comes to state issues. Obviously, with planes, that's not our jurisdiction. That's FAA. So this board will not handle animal disease, okay? That stays with the Board of Animal Health. And this board frees up the Board of Animal Health to get back to their mission of animal disease control, which is important, especially now. It also seems like every couple of year, there's cervidae or bovine tuberculosis or something that we deal with on DNR or ag issues, which is very important for them to focus on, not the companion animal issues that we're talking about here. The duties of the board will be, it's 13 members, with companion animal expertise and skills. It'll have three duties: enforcement of companion animal regulatory laws, providing education and communication about companion animal issues, and coordinating services and resources throughout Minnesota. So it's critical that we establish the board now to get the right structure in place to address issues that are current and upcoming that involve companion animals and community needs. So with that, I have testifiers, Mr. Chair, if they could come up. And
sure, that'd be great. Yes, I have four people who signed up to testify, and I'll see if there's anybody else after they have testified. First on the list I have is Ann Olson. We do have a very full agenda, so I'm going to try to adhere to about a 2 or 3 minute limit per testifier today on all bills. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hello. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yes, now I can. Okay.
My name is Ann Olson, and I'm with an organization called Animal Folks. We deal with animal protection and welfare issues in Minnesota. We strongly support House File 3584, which will create a companion animal board. The role of companion animals in the lives of Minnesota is huge and changing. Companion animals, which includes pets, are part of the family. More families have a dog or cat than children. And the pet industry has grown to over $75 billion. This type of board is long overdue. As Representative Lesh explained, Minnesota government right now is structured around livestock and wildlife, but there's nothing for companion animals. This has been a problem. Two regulatory laws involving companion animals ended up with the Board of Animal Health because there was no other place to put them. But the core mission of the Board of Animal Health is animal disease control with a focus on agriculture due to food consumption. But companion animals are not agricultural products. They are not eaten or worn. Companion animals are about companionship. And that companionship requires a different level of expertise. This bill is about expertise. The board will have specific skills and expertise in companion animal health, welfare, and well-being. And we'll work with organizations, businesses, communities throughout Minnesota that care for these animals. Now, as for issues and needs, there are numerous of them involving companion animals. Just a few examples: emergency and disaster relief. Nonprofits who save companion animals during these situations need state assistance. Two, enforcement of regulatory law. The commercial dog and cat breeder law and the kennel and dealer law, which licenses shelters, would be transferred to this board. Possible regulation of animal rescue groups. There's a lot of talk about that in the future. This board could assume that duty. Questions to legislators or from the public on specific topics, like what is a service dog versus an emotional support dog versus a therapy dog? This board could provide a forum for that discussion. But another vital issue, companion animals are critically important to those with physical and mental illnesses such as PTSD, depression, anxiety. This board would collaborate with Human Health Services to help both animals and people. Just want to mention that also this bill was reintroduced because we've had numerous conversations with organizations and individuals in the last year, so changes were made. We spoke with the Board of Animal Health. They gave their input. That's been incorporated into the bill. We did meet with the Minnesota Pet Breeders Associations. They declined to participate, but a breeder was added to the board. And we've been meeting with the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association, and the bill language was changed to reflect their input. So the issues, to conclude, faced by the state concerning companion animals, we believe will only, will only get bigger and greater. This is a growing industry, and there needs to be a structure in place to handle it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Next on the list, I have Pamela Schreiner. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you. My name is Dr. Pam Schreiner. I'm a professor of cardiovascular epidemiology in the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. But probably more relevant to this discussion is my role as director of the Center to Study Human-Animal Relationships and Environments, or CENSHARE, which studies the health benefits of the human-animal bond. Of particular concern for public health is the health of our elderly. And currently, the U.S. population is expected to grow by 8% between 2015 and 2025, but those between the ages of 70 and 84 will increase by 50%. So as demographics, family units, and longevity changes, companion animals will play a crucial role in public health in this state. Specifically, they lead to a reduction in loneliness and isolation through the pro-social influence of animals, reduction in depression through increased physical activity and responsibility for caring for another creature, and the buffering effect that animals have in facilitating human interactions. They also improve nutrition in our elderly. Studies have found that when seniors prepare meals for their companion animals, they prepare more regular meals with more vegetables and dairy for themselves. In addition, they lead to improved self-care. The concern that their companion animal will not survive without them leads to better health habits and more regular medical checkups. They are family members. So SenShare strives to conduct quality research to better understand how these companion animals influence our lives and health. I support the creation of the Companion Animal Board because of its role in serving as a hub for educational resources, expertise in state and local governments on issues in this unique animal population, and its influence on public policy supporting humane education and outreach to benefit our population. Please support HF 3584. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Schreiner. Next, I have Kathy Mock. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kathy Mock, and I'm the Chief Government Affairs and Community Engagement Officer at the Animal Humane Society. I'm here to express the Humane Society's support for House File 3584. A little bit of background about the Animal Humane Society. We've been actually in Minnesota and caring for companion animals for over 140 years. We're a local 501c3 animal welfare organization, and we have four different locations. We operate in St. Paul, Coon Rapids, Woodbury, and Golden Valley, our main hub where I work. I should remember that one. every year we care for more than 23,000 animals in need. Through some of our innovations and medical treatments, we're able to help animals, even animals with significant challenges. As a result, 94% of the animals that we see we're able to help and place. We also work to combat pet overpopulation. We have 16 veterinarians that provide low-cost spay and neuter services to pets in the community. And we've expanded our efforts to help people in underserved communities so they can actually keep their pet in their home and the pets don't have to come to the shelter. Our wellness services and other services that we provide to people we support over 100,000 animals and their families each year. So based on all of this, we're really on the front line of these animal welfare issues and really see the need for the Companion Animal Board, a board to specifically oversee the growing needs of companion animals and their caretakers is important. Like it's been said a couple of times already, our research shows that 65% of Minnesotans' households actually include a pet, and 95% of those people consider their pet a part of the family. So as the importance of companion animals in people's lives grows, the more issues will come up, and the more it's imperative that we set up a board like the Companion Animal Board to oversee and assist people with their issues and their animals. So we think the board is really a common sense approach that will address future and current animal needs and really urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mock. Next on the list, I have Elaine Hansen. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chairman Freiberg and committee, I'm Elaine Hansen. I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Pet Breeders Association, of which I am the legislative chair. I heard Representative Lesh mention that he had sworn off animal bills in 2007. I wasn't involved at that time and didn't hear it, but I distinctly remember him renewing that vow in 2014. So here we are again. In 2014, the legislature passed a bill establishing regulations for commercial dog and cat breeders and a system to monitor them, correct deficiencies, impose penalties for noncompliance with standards. This function was generously funded. The appropriation was actually at the level proposed by the proponents of the bill, who had conjectured that there were three times as many dog and cat breeders that would come within its jurisdiction than the actual 123 commercial breeders that have been identified in the past 5 years. And in my experience with 33 years as a state employee, I believe that was the first bill I ever saw that I was paying close attention to, at least, that was given the appropriation as requested. It was quite unprecedented in my view. I'll be referring to dogs because there are only a handful of commercial cat breeders, and most of the concern about animal welfare and pet breeding is focused on dogs. The Board of Animal Health has carried out its mission of licensing commercial breeders and monitoring their performance according to the standards set in statute, with protocols for health care and documentation of practices as needed. The board regularly updates the Minnesota Pet Breeders Association at our annual educational seminar. We've been holding that seminar since 2005, which may have been the first time a breeder regulation bill was proposed to the legislature. When breeder licensing became required, some breeders had to make adjustments in their facilities or practices to come into compliance. Some chose not to do so, and they are no longer commercial breeders. I'm aware of one commercial breeder's license that has been revoked for persistent non-compliance. Commercial breeders are not having any difficulty complying with the regulations. The rest of the commercial breeders are pleased to continue raising happy, healthy puppies sold with warranties to protect consumers as required by law. You may wish to note that the groups reselling homeless pets are not required to provide any history for them and no warranty whatsoever as to their health or source or suitability as pets, neither the ones they obtain locally nor the thousands they import to supply Minnesotans with enough pets. The Board of Animal Health has many years of experience monitoring conditions in which domestic animals are kept and cared for. Earlier speakers pointed out that the board also licenses and inspects Minnesota pet shelters. They're called kennels under the law. In 1967, more than 50 years ago, the legislature enacted a law requiring that organizations sheltering homeless pets operate according to standards set, monitored, and enforced by the State Livestock Sanitary Board, a predecessor to the Board of Animal Health. Thus, regulating commercial breeders was not a novel or mysterious responsibility thrust upon the board in 2014. It was a variation of a program that had been ongoing for decades, the major difference being that the kennels, pet shelters, were looking after pets that had been lost, abandoned, neglected, or mistreated, while commercial breeders are professionals who ethically, competently, and responsibly raise dogs intended to become family pets or working partners with hunters, farmers and ranchers, law enforcement, people with disabilities, or are selectively bred for other reasons. In other words, purpose-bred pets. This expansion of the board's responsibilities was set on the foundation provided by years of experience with oversight of pet shelters. You can see the similarities in the standards, the inspection guidelines for the pet sheltering and pet breeding programs that are on the board's website. Excuse me. There is no need to duplicate these functions in a new agency. The board has the capability and the capacity and should continue to perform this work in the interests of animal and public health. Commercial breeders, like all pet owners, have to comply with Minnesota's humane laws as well as the commercial breeder licensing standards. The prevention to cruelty of animals statutes are set forth in Chapter 343 with some supporting provisions in Chapters 346 and 347. There is a system for enforcing the broad-based humane laws that is completely separate from the licensing and inspection of pet shelters and commercial breeders.
If you could wrap up your testimony.
I will.
Thank you.
The two systems are required to communicate relevant information with each other, even though separate. I could provide more details if you are interested. There's a little more to this in the material that I provided in your packets, and I would be glad to have a conversation or to answer questions with anyone who needs more. In summary, there's no need to replace the expertise of the Board of Animal Health with a group that has long been concerned with an essential but very different aspect of the role animals play in our lives and is seeking to branch into new territory. It would be a needless and inappropriate use of the state's limited resources, and I urge you to vote no on House File 3584.
Thank you. Yep, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 3584? Okay, seeing none, we'll go to member discussion. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. Representative Lash, I'm a big hunter, and I have lots of friends that have dogs bred for hunting. Tell me again, because we were talking before we started, how could this possibly impact breeders along those lines?
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nash. So this bill merely creates a board, okay, and it's a nothing is expressly necessarily spelled out other than the fact that the jurisdiction area is related to companion animals. There is substantial sensitivity around animal issues in general in the state. Under that umbrella, there is a special sensitivity with respect to breeders who wants to have a say in our business, how we do business. Hunting dogs, you may recall former Representative Moe was a musher. Didn't you serve with Moe? I'm totally dating myself, aren't I? Okay, well, he was here like, I don't know, 100 years ago. Not is he here?
No, he's not.
Okay, well, that'd be embarrassing. Yeah, okay, Nelson was here. But he was a musher, okay? And he had also particular sensitivity of like, you know, who's talking about, you know, my sled dogs. So there's sensitivity around all those areas and suspicion about, you know, how is this going to affect me? But I just want to stress that this simply creates the board. If there are additional parameters around, you know, how that could impact, you know, hunting dogs or sled dogs or anything, that would have to be, I think, decided at a later date or borne out in how this board and the Board of Animal Health or the DNR or Ag decides their joint jurisdictional areas. That's the best answer I can give you.
Representative Nash.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lesh, well, that's kind of my question is, you know, so our dogs, and you know, we've got two dogs and a cat, and the cat doesn't hunt with me, but he hunts in the yard. But my question is this, so the hunting dogs are companion animals as well. I mean, they're part of our family. You know, some of the closest relationships I think you'll ever see are between an owner and a hunting dog, super close. And I just want to make sure that we're not setting that up for some disaster with this board. I don't think you're trying to do that. I'm just trying to make sure that we get author's intent on the record to say this is not designed to go after breeders of hunting dogs or herding dogs or whatever. Just trying to make sure that we get that out there on the record.
Well.
Representative Lesh, briefly.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and Representative Nash. So when a court looks at legislative intent, they look at the committee record. So I can state right into the microphone, you know, my intent is this with respect to hunting dogs or breeders or whatever, and the courts won't care. They'll look at the discussion of the committee and what is borne out in committee, what the intent is. It has a factor, and the conversation on the floor of the House matters as well. But I would say that the intent, the author's intent, is to establish a board that has expertise over issues relating to companion animals and can give advice on that. But it's not specifically to regulate hunting dogs or the breeding of hunting dogs. You know, we had that big bill, and I think I washed it from my memory, but it's out there, but the bill dealing with breeders a few years back. This is not that bill, and I realize there's still some sensitivity with respect to that, how that got passed, but remember that bill was passed by reaching consensus with most stakeholders, okay, and there was still a sensitivity about it, and I remember one of the major consensus pieces that I had to eat was the data practices piece, okay? People wanted to know, okay, if there were breeders who were unscrupulous, and that went on record with the Board of Animal Health or with the state, would that be public data? And the breeders were saying, we don't want activists coming to our, you know, breeding operations and causing problems because it was public information. So I had, as an open government guy, I had to swallow that and say, okay, fine, we're not going to make it public data. And that was one of the major points that we used to arrive at a consensus on that. But that's not what this bill is about. This bill is about creating a board that has an expertise that can make those recommendations. Would it potentially stray into that if there was some issue? You know, I can't promise that it wouldn't.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Lesh. You done, Representative Nash?
Just real quick, since it is, thank you, Mr. Chair, and since it is, intent is discovered here in committee, I do think it's important that we make sure that as we move forward on this, that we do state clearly that we're not trying to go after the breeding of, ethical breeding of hunting dogs. Again, just, you know, if you've been in the field with a dog, they're super close to the people who own them, and it's really something to see. And I don't want it that this, which I also believe is valuable, because my pets are pretty close to me. Want to make sure that those two don't trample on one another. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a friend who has, you know, it's a companion dog, but she takes it into the schools as kind of a therapy dog. So would that portion, do you think, fall under this legislation?
Chair Lesh.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mason, in short, yes. Companion animal, therapy animal, would be contemplated by a board with the expertise of the members here on it. That, as an example, I have many friends who are veterans in my unit, who I'm convinced their lives have been saved. They did not commit suicide because of their relationship with their companion animal. It is critically important. So ensuring that relationship remains intact as much as any relationship with a hunting dog, the closest or with a therapy animal as well. Yeah, that would fall under this, and making sure that those animals are taken care of and we have the expertise on them.
Representative
Thank
Mason.
You.
Okay. Is there additional member discussion? Okay. Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3584 be re-referred to the Agriculture Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Understand we have a testifier from out of town, so I'm going to switch up the agenda a little bit and ask Representative New to come forward.
Is she from out of town? So you're not from out of town. Oh.
There's actually a city council meeting.
Yeah. So when we have House File 3242. On the agenda, I will move that House File 3242 be referred to the General Register. Welcome to the committee, Representative New. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you for the indulgence. I have my city administrator here right now, and there's a city council meeting tonight, so I appreciate you letting us present the bill right now. This is a pretty simple bill. All we're doing, we've got a utilities commission in the city of North Branch for our water and light. It is currently a 3-member commission. We'd like to move that to a 5-member commission. And with that, I'd love to turn the time over to my city administrator, if that's okay.
Sure. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, and thank you, Representative New. My name is Renee Fry. I'm the city administrator with the city of North Branch. North Branch actually has a separate public utility that provides electrical service and water service to our community. And this, I think, has been a request that was made in the past, but more recently, this past winter, the Water and Light Commission reached out to our city council and asked that the council support a measure to seek special legislation to increase the size of the commission from 3 to 5. Our council unanimously supported that request and directed me to work with Representative New and Senator Coran to bring forth special legislation to this body and obviously to our state government. Our commission is a very small body when you think about the scope of work that they need to undertake. The utility itself really has no robust planning. It has not a comprehensive budgeting process. It doesn't have a strategic plan. It doesn't have a capital improvement plan. And these are all things that have been identified as being critically important for this utility to remain a viable partner and collaborator with the work that the city is doing. The city suffered when the recession happened in 08, and the utility basically shifted into just operational mode. We're just going to try to keep the lights on and go day to day. The city is growing. We have tremendous housing development as well as commercial development, and we need our utility to be a collaborator and, as I mentioned, a partner in meeting our development needs. And there's just, frankly, too much work that a 3-person volunteer committee can do. So we support this legislation in the hopes that we can go to a 5-member commission and that the great work that needs to be done can be undertaken efficiently And did I mention it's volunteer? These folks put in a lot of hours for about $600 a year. So we really do want to make sure that we're supporting their work and their efforts.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Chris DeBose. I'm a Chisago County Commissioner, and North Branch is part of my district. I mean, North Branch is a small town, small staff, but experiencing a high rate of growth. And this will really help with these extra volunteers. It's going to help a lot of the workload and for planning, because they don't have a lot of the planning done and need to accomplish that. So appreciate your support.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 3242? Okay, seeing none, any member discussion? Okay, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3242 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Edelson. We have House File 3106.
Yes, Chair, and I also have an amendment, A1.
And 3106, I will move House File 3106 be referred to the Education Finance Division. And we have an A1 amendment. Is this just to put the bill in the shape you would like, Representative Edelson?
Yes, Chair.
Okay, sure. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Okay, seeing none, all in favor of I will move the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment's adopted. Please present your bill, Representative Edelson.
Chair and members, the House Bill 3106 is the Standardized Assessment Task Force. Many of you, if you sat on an education committee, might think, well, we've done this before. We have, about 3 years ago. But why we are looking to do this again is because what we have seen in the state of Minnesota for the Minnesota Comprehension Assessment Test is a number that is increasing in terms of opt-out rates and refusals for students. In 10th grade and 11th grade, we've also seen a large number of 8th graders start to opt out as well. And so it begins to say, why are we seeing this increase in trends? And so this task force, which would include some of the task force members that were part of the 2017 group to be a part of this, to look at what they did then, but just getting experts around the table to see how are we using this data, why are we seeing a trend in opt-outs, and also look at the achievement gap as well when they're doing this. Because these tests are definitely find inequities, but they don't always fix them. So I want to move right to my testifier, Mr. Heistad.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Chairman Freiberg and committee members, my name is Dave Heistad. I'm the Executive Director of Research, Evaluation, and Assessment in Bloomington Public Schools, and had the same position in Minneapolis for 15 years prior to coming to Bloomington. I'm testifying in favor of House File 3106 for the establishment of the Standardized Test Force. Standardized assessments must be reviewed, and I'm really pleased that the purpose of the committee is to make the current assessment system more meaningful, reliable, and useful for schools, students, and families. In particular, I'm interested in the reports that are provided to families and to students, and the delay in the reports coming in the fall of the year rather than right after the test is given in the spring. As 25 years as an assessment expert in Minneapolis Public Schools, I help develop local district assessments that are aligned to specific purposes. And some assessments are for instructional use at the classroom level. Some provide specific account of academic difficulty assessment, and some are for accountability at the school board or at the state level. And each of these purposes have standards, national standards associated with them. We need to make sure that the standards are being adhered to. It is very important for teachers, students, and parents to be involved in the process, so I'm pleased that they're on the board. It does appear that students are less motivated to take state tests. Overall, 44% increase in the opt-outs, and in particular in high school. This task force should address the issue of motivations of students and opt-outs, also bias review of the tests, and the timely and useful reporting. I believe this task force will provide value added to our fine educational system here in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Heistad. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? Sure, Mr. Heller, please approach the table and please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Rick Heller. Unofficial represent the Twice Exceptional and people with print disabilities. Thanks for this opportunity to come and speak in government operations today regarding the Bill 3106. I have a handout here I provided to your LA. I don't see it online, however. I'd ask that that be handed out today. It has to do with a complaint that the Minnesota Department of Education, I did copy everybody on this committee and the chairs on education policy and finance as well. Also, I will give the lead here a copy of the stuff I sent her, timely or not, but if those who are listening, the State Department back in February 19, 2019 had a complaint filed, and they had a decision that came out of that, and it had to do with a large amount of individuals. It's blackened out, however, the approximately 20 students were found to be taken not the MCA's modified assessments. On page you find that on page one, but when you go to page 59 and 60 attached, it said MCAs with accommodations under the first decision. I highlighted that for you specifically. It's my belief that they're going to look at assessments. They need to look at how parents know if it's a standard-based IEP or not. I provided you the link where Carla Nelson sit on the floor to accept the bill. I'll provide that with the author of the bill. And having a checkbox on an IEP that frankly identifies a standard-based IEP, that's one of the items. And frankly, if parents don't know what's a standard-based IEP or a modified IEP, frankly, that will help them determine what assessment they should take, frankly, especially if the IEP team or the staff at the school don't know that the modified assessments read out loud. However, thanks to the great work at the Minnesota Department of Education, the new MCA 3s do read out loud. However, but the reading tests typically are not read out loud. Those kids likely that would have took those assessments would have been opted out of the big picture, but they would have been allowed to be in it, believe it or not. So you can check with the State Department of Education or not. But I don't believe they'd be part of the cohort, but they at least took the assessment, if that's what you're looking at. I think that's a relevant piece. Also, those that are scribbling down notes, these are the other four documents that you find at the work that the MDE is doing at the State Department. And they all start with MDE, but if you put these six digits in there, you will find these documents in the search engine. The digits are 087547.
If you could wrap up your testimony, Mr. Hill.
031919 and 085591. I would ask for an oral amendment or somebody that when they move this over the policy, that somehow they integrate the accommodation as it relates to the accessibility on these new assessments that are required for individuals, because is it really that we can read or is it that we can understand oral English? Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Heller. And this bill is going to the Education Finance Division, so there will be an opportunity to address some of the issues you raised. Our page, Jordina, could you maybe?
Hopefully you will post
grab
the
those.
Chair.
Okay, I think she handed some things out already, yes.
Okay, and then the chair, excuse me, but that the minutes would reflect that unofficial representative Twice Exceptional that I had a handout. Again, thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 3106? Okay. Seeing none, member discussion. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. Representative Edelson, is there going to be a geographic balance that you're putting into this? Because that was not something that I saw in the bill. I wanted to make sure that we're addressing outstate and metro alike. Didn't see that in the bill. I want to make sure that that does get put in if it's not there, because I think that is very, very important.
Representative Edelson.
Chair, Representative Nash, that's a really good point, and I can add that as an amendment when we go to Education Finance.
Okay. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the author mentioned that in 2017 there was a task force or work group. There also was one in 2015 and 2012. There are multiple recommendations brought forward. There's also an OLA evaluation was done with recommendations. Yeah. And so we've got lots of input, and so I would have preferred that we actually are taking action instead of let's have another group look at this and give input, because the students that are sitting in the desks now deserve action, not another work group or task force to evaluate and look at stuff. I mean, we for decades have had an issue, and we continually do work groups, and we don't seem to make any progress. One of your testifiers touched on some testing and doing the fall versus spring. The NWEA and other testing are done several times a year. Real-time feedback to the teachers so they can adjust the curriculum and the materials and the focus and help the students in the classroom. We've known about that, and some districts have actually utilized that and have been successful. That's action instead of, you know, more, you know, testing, evaluation, and et cetera. So I understand the intent, but at some time you gotta say it's soup and go forward and serve up results to the students. So that's my cautionary about doing another work group. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Edelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I absolutely agree with you. I do have a separate bill that actually looks at doing a pilot for high school students to innovation zone schools doing the ACT instead of the MCA. Again, a pilot in addition to doing this task force, because what we have seen, the numbers since 2017 have doubled in terms of opt-outs for 10th and 11th graders. So I do think that we need to, things have changed from the task force that we had before. And so why are students opting out in Edina? One way that we got students to take the MCA in 10th grade, or was it a 10th grade science, right? Science is in 10th, okay, good. 10th grade science was to say that they could not take their end of year final and instead do their MCA. And we saw the numbers increase for participation and grade. That grade outcome was really impressive. And so I think the task force is just constantly looking at it, but I would like to see more action. So it's noted. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It'd be nice if the staff could let us know. I'm assuming that the Department of Education actually, you know, they collect a lot of data. They have a lot of meetings. They could actually maybe have some other people that are working on this type and also looking at what, you know, an example of a school doing something, you know, because I assume in their funding we want them to you know, not just collect data, but analyze it. So it might be nice to understand what the department's actually doing. And so if we did do a task force, it would augment and complement the existing activity instead of being separated from, and maybe that's the reason why we're not implementing things. So if the committee could find out, thank you.
Representative Edelson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, we've actually been working with MD closely on this legislation.
Thank you. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. About a year ago when I was meeting with one of my school districts, they had three students that were at the table as well. And this particular body would like to see some of the tests just go away because they're not really relevant. And the three students were saying, you know, they would study for tests that made a difference and how they were going to get accepted into college, for instance. But they didn't waste their time on the state test because it has no relevance to them. So why would they take the time away from their schedule? So, I mean, something needs to be done. And again, from the one district, they would just like it, this to go away.
Mr. Heistad.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Mason, we have this bill 3107, which is requesting ability to pilot the ACT, which is much more consequential for high school students. We had two high school students from Hopkins testify, and they gave exactly the kind of testimony that you have heard, that students really don't value the state test. It's a real motivational problem, and that they want to have it count, you know. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Mason. Any additional discussion on House File 3106? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Edelson?
No, I just thank member for their time.
Thank you. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3106, as amended, be referred to the Education Finance Division. All those in favor, please say aye. 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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Edelson. Okay. So, Representative Olson, welcome to the committee, Representative Olson. You have House File 3838, and let's see, this is going to, can you tell me where this is going? The HHS Finance Division. I will move that House File 3838 be referred to the HHS Finance Division. Please present your bill, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have Representative Baker here with me as well to co-present. This is a follow-up from House File 400, last year's opioid stewardship bill. As with any bill that size and doing the landmark work that we did in that legislation, there is some cleanup that needs to happen. So this is a very narrow set of items that we're trying to work on in this bill that have been agreed to with the Senate authors that worked on the bill last year, with Representative Baker, with the Opioid Advisory Stewardship Council that we set up as well. So, and the reason this bill is here today is because there are, as I mentioned, in the House File 400 last year, we set up an Opioid Stewardship Advisory Council as part of that legislation, and there are two things that we needed to change in that and how we set that up. And both of these changes that are in the bill have already been voted on by the Opioid Stewardship Council, which Representative Cagle and Representative Baker sit on. And so in the bill, you'll see that we clarify that the members representing the Minnesota Hospital Association are appointed by the MHA. Currently, this seat is to be appointed by the commissioner. However, the other professional associations can select their own appointment to the council, so this change would align the Minnesota Hospital Association seat with how advisory council members from other professional associations are appointed. And it also specifies that the advisory council members are appointed for three-year terms. The advisory council members recently voted on and have approved these. So with that, I'm open for questions, and Representative Baker can certainly speak to anything too, but that is why we're here.
Would you like to say anything, Representative Baker?
Due to time, Mr. Chair, I'll just take questions. If there are, I'm proud to serve on the council right now. We are working very, very hard to find the areas of gaps that we need to get to our communities around Minnesota for addiction resources, and we are working really hard. So I'm just really here to answer any questions without taking any further time. But these are very small, minor tweaks to our council makeup, and with that, I'll stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Is there anyone who would like to testify regarding House File 3838? Okay, seeing none, is there any member discussion? Okay, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3838 be referred to the HHS Finance Division. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Representative Liebling. We have House File 4327. I will move that House File 4327 be referred to the Judiciary Committee. Please present your bill, Representative Lee.
All right. Well, good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for taking this up. I am here with House File 4327, which is a continuing part of our continuing response to the COVID-19 issue that we had up on the House floor last night. And thank you to all the members. We were able to pass the appropriation piece of this very quickly with unanimously, as I understand. I think maybe one person was missing, but that was just wonderful. So we're here today with a couple of pieces. I think only one of them is really in the jurisdiction of the committee, and that is the emergency powers piece under Chapter 12. And in reviewing what is needed or possibly needed to confront a pandemic, if we have one, it was recognized that there's a little bit of a lack of clarity in Chapter 12, where there's a definition of a peacetime emergency. So Chapter 12 gives the governor powers. It says the governor may declare a peacetime emergency, and then it goes on to say a peacetime declaration of emergency may only be declared when an act of nature, a technological failure or malfunction, et cetera, occurs. And we do believe that an act of nature would probably encompass a public health emergency, but we also don't want there to be any sort of dispute about that should it become necessary for the governor to exercise certain powers, such as quarantine or other things. So what this bill is really doing is explicitly calling out a public health emergency in Chapter 12 with the emergency powers. The other piece of this that is different is that we would like to be able to have a public health emergency be continued for up to 90 days instead of the 30 days that is already in statute for these kinds of emergencies. The reason for that is just because of the very nature of a public health emergency, that and the way infectious agents can spread in the population. So it's up to 90 days, and all of the other protections or the way Chapter 12 already works is left in place. So as you can see from the bill, the first section defines a public health emergency, and it's my understanding that the language that's there that is specific is basically taken from other statutes where the similar thing is defined. And I guess, you know, I'm certainly not an expert on Chapter 12, so if there are questions about what kind of powers there are, I guess I would ask House Research to talk more about that. Mm-hmm. And that is the part of the bill that I think is clearly in the jurisdiction of this committee, Mr. Chair. And if you'd like me to talk about the other piece, I certainly would be happy to do so.
We can leave it at that for the moment. Thank you, Chair Liebling. Is there anyone who would like to testify on House File 4327?
And I do have, Mr. Chair, I do have people from the Department of Health who could speak to it if there are questions, but in sure. The interest of time, just to let you know.
Thank you for letting me know, Chair Liebling. So seeing nobody who wishes to testify on the bill, we will go to member discussion, and I see there is an amendment too, so I don't believe this is not your amendment. So if somebody would like to offer that, they could certainly do that at this point as well. Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is my amendment, and Chair Liebling and the author should be somewhat familiar because I've offered a quarantine bill several different sessions and terms because, well, a good example is with this current issue before us with the coronavirus, there have been people that did not go into a voluntary quarantine and they communicated, I think it was at some university where they went to some social events and there was some spread. And frankly, we should make quarantine less egregious so that people will come forward, get tested, comply. And that is the intent of this, the amendment and the bill. And unfortunately, there hasn't been any discussion. And really, it'd be nice to have these type of details, which are you know, key if we had the emergency that the bill before us is addressing. And I'm not married to all of the possible alleviations if there was one felt egregious, but I am married to the effect or the intent that we actually try to show the public that we're thoughtful about the quarantine procedures and care about making it less difficult for the people that unfortunately would be found under quarantine if we had a large outbreak.
Did you have any comments on it, Chair Levin?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate Representative Quam's statement of his intention with this amendment, but that is not what the amendment does. So, members, if you would look at lines 2.1 to 2.5 of the amendment, language that is being struck in the amendment: an employer shall not discharge, discipline, threaten, or penalize a qualifying employee or otherwise discriminate in the work terms, conditions, location, or privileges of the employee. So basically what the amendment is doing is it's saying that it's okay for employers to fire somebody or do those other things I just listed out. But if they do and you have some economic hardship, we'll do some things to try to mitigate that economic hardship, like maybe help you get your loans deferred and stuff like that. That's what the amendment is doing. So, Mr. Chair, while I appreciate Representative Quam's stated intent, the underlying legislation, he carried it, I believe, 2 years ago, and it was good legislation. Department of Health supported it. This amendment goes completely the wrong direction. In fact, I believe that we should be telling employers, not only do you have to let your person be in quarantine if they need to be, or other language that's being struck here is they can't do that to people who are taking care of a person in quarantine. We should be moving to have employers pay the sick leave. Instead, this amendment is going the complete opposite direction and saying it's okay if you want to fire your employee because they're in quarantine. I don't think we want that. So I would seriously ask members to vote no on this amendment.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, you may have noticed, Representative Liebling, I did not move the amendment yet.
I noticed that.
And Mr. Chair, if you read further, there's areas about allowing and making it possible for a person to work from home. There's discussion about flexibility with, you know, covering the time off while you're under quarantine. There's requiring a request for a waiver on federal student loans during the period. There's discussion about, you know, to credit agencies, saying, you know, if there are any, you know, late events or any issues, that they be not detrimental to a person's credit because they are, you know, there's also a court, so that we can actually say, if you're under quarantine, you can't have a detrimental determination because you're not showing up to a court date and case, which I assume the judge probably doesn't want someone with a communicable disease under quarantine actually showing up in the courtroom. And as I stated before, I am not wedded to any of these items. I'm wedded to addressing them. And the reason I brought this forth as a amendment is, frankly, we ought to have a hearing, especially when we're looking at the possibility of a larger amount of quarantine than we normally see, to discuss what options would be present and put forth a unified approach. This was meant for start the discussion. And I'm just disappointed, and this is the first time, my first term, I haven't been on one of the HHS committees. So frankly, we ought to be able to have a discussion in HHS about quarantine at this time. And I am not going to offer this as an amendment, but it's just pointing out that at least we brushed on, touched the topic. And from past experiences, it is somewhat controversial, some of the items. And that doesn't mean that we don't do the hard work, and we should do it before we need to do something, and it's more thoughtful than where we have to do an emergency measure to fix something we should have done during the intervening years. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Is there any additional member discussion? Representative Vogel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. As I look through the bill, there's a lot of discussion about how these loans would be made. And is there anything in here? I don't see it about the repayment of loan. In other words, it becomes an actual revolving loan fund, something like the RFA that we just did, rather than maybe a grant program because the loans don't get paid back?
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Vogel. I didn't really do an introduction of this piece because I don't know if you were here when I introduced it. My feeling was that this part really isn't in the jurisdiction of the committee. I'm glad to discuss it if the chair wishes.
Maybe just briefly respond to the question.
Well, so I think the answer, Representative Vogel, is that we very much intend to do what you just brought up. And this was, this is moving pretty quickly. Over in the Senate, my understanding is they tried to do some kind of a grant fund and, weren't able to do that. And so this was my recommendation that we set up a loan fund. So it is very much a work in progress. We will be amending it in Health and Human Services Finance. But we're, frankly, we want to take some testimony first and get the details of it worked out exactly right because, really, for the reason you say, it's intended to be a loan fund. It isn't really specific enough yet about what the terms would be. There are other loan funds in state law that, so we're pulling together the expertise to try to do this the right way. But you're absolutely right. We want, and if I could just say a word about the purpose of this, the money that we passed last night really did not include much, if anything, that would be available to the hospitals or the clinics or the emergency medical services who really could have some pretty heavy expenses if this thing really took off. And so our intent was to do something that really strikes a careful balance between using state funds to address those concerns, because we don't want to lose healthcare providers who don't have cash flow or are suddenly overwhelmed or something. We want resources distributed across the state where they are needed. At the same time, we don't want to just be giving out money because people say, oh, we need this, we need that. We need a really careful process that requires, that allows cash flow for organizations, but that directs it really where it needs to go. So the expectation that it would have to be paid back is really important to that, I think. I'm not intending to put loan forgiveness into this language only because my belief is that entities can always come back to the legislature and say, gosh, we had this thing happen and we really cannot pay it back, and then it could be forgiven by the legislature, frankly, in the normal course. So that's kind of my thinking around this. I do want to say, and thank you for the opportunity, I really welcome input from members on this. This is not just a Tina Liebling thing. This has to be something that, I don't have particular expertise in how loan funds work and so on, so I'm trying to get expertise from departments. I certainly welcome member input, and I appreciate the question. Yeah.
Thank you, Vogel. Mr. Chair.
Yep, thank you. Any additional member discussion? Representative Lehman.
Just quickly, Mr. Chair, and Representative Liebling, reference this, and I think it might be good for us to hear and the public to know as well that this bill does extend privilege to declare a public health emergency up to 90 days. And Representative Liebling deferred, I think, to the research staff to talk about, like, just hear what those executive powers are that were provided.
Mr. Guerin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lehman, so the emergency powers that are provided in Chapter 12 are fairly broad. I'll just give you a few examples. As the bill is drafted, this allows the governor to declare a peacetime emergency and designate it as a public health emergency. So the first effect of that emergency declaration, as I read it, would be that the emergency would last for 5 days, and then the executive council would have the authority to extend it for up to 90 days. And the effect of declaring a peacetime emergency allows the governor to do things that are required by statute, including entering contracts, hiring temporary employees, renting equipment and supplies, and those sorts of things without having to go through the normal contracting and procurement process to do those things. The governor also has authority in the event of a declared emergency to do things like direct health personnel and law enforcement personnel to particular parts of the state to perform duties, including directing local public health authorities to other areas of the state to provide services in between subdivisions. So there's a number of powers like that in statute that effectively allow the governor to
Not a good time to cough.
Sorry about that. So there are a number of powers like that that effectively allow the governor to sort of speed up the provision of services and resources to parts of the state.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I think that's really helpful for people to know. It looks like it allows the governor to expedite the movement of resources and people for this period of time. So thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Elaine. Any additional member discussion? Okay, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 4327 be referred to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Chair Liebling.
Thank you, members.
Chair Moran, you have a couple bills before us. First on the agenda, I have House File 771. And so I will move that House File 771 be referred to the HHS Finance Division. Chair Moran, would you like me to explain the situation with the amendments
yes.
before I start here?
Yes, could you please?
Sure. Okay, so Representative Moran, in a previous committee stop, there were some questions raised about the expiration date of the council at this bill. Representative Moran prepared an amendment that met the deadline, which is the A1 amendment, which is in your packet, that addresses those issues. I spoke a little bit to our House research. This is the sort of question that is very much within the jurisdiction of the Government Operations Commission. So I did talk to House research a little bit about that, and I had the A2 amendment prepared, which I've discussed with Chair Moran. And it sounds like she's okay with that. It did not meet the deadline. It doesn't really make a substantive difference from the A1 amendment, but it does make it a little bit clearer how the expiration date works. And I think maybe, Mr. Gehring, if you'd like to just sort of explain what the amendment would do.
Sure, Mr. Chair. So the amendment that's proposed is really just a technical amendment to move the stated sort of public policy intent to have the commission exist until disparities no longer exist in Minnesota into the purpose statement of the bill, and then gets rid of the actual expiration date. And the reason for that is just that's our sort of staff recommended best practices for drafting expiration dates, is that you want to make sure that you have a clear objective time that a commission ends or doesn't end. So the amendment would address that issue.
Yes. So I explained the amendment prior to the meeting to GOP research and ranking member Quam. Like I said, it did not meet the deadline. I think it is a technical amendment. So I just throw it out there for members. I guess I think it makes the language a little more clear about the expiration date. Is there any member comment on that? Okay, I'm not seeing any. So I'm going to interpret that to mean that members are okay with that. So it's been handed out. It's the A2 amendment. There should be extra copies for members of the public. So I will move the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted. Chair Moran, thank you for your indulgence, members, there. Like I said, I think this makes that language a little bit more gov-opsy, if that's a word. Moran, would you like
thank
to
you,
describe your bill?
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. Mm-hmm. So a little back history of the bill. The legislature created the Cultural and Ethnic Community Leadership Council during the 2013 legislative session.
I carried the bill back then. The purpose of the council is to advise the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services, which is DHS, on reducing disparities and inequities that affect racial and ethnic groups within DHS programs. The council consists of 15 to 25 members appointed by the commissioner and is charged with reviewing DHS policies for racial, ethnic, cultural, linguistic, and tribal disparities and providing an annual report regarding equitable delivery of service. So this work is not done, it's not completed yet, and so what this new bill is removes the sunsets.
Thank you, Chair Moran. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Maria Sarabia. I serve as the chair for the Cultural and Ethnic Community Leadership Council. And I would just like to state that the council is a rich collective of racial and ethnically diverse community members who are working in partnership with the agency as well as the legislature and community to advance this work. We thank you for your support and encourage you to consider staying abreast of all the work that we're doing. We're really trying to push for accountability and progress to address disparities. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Robbie. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good day. My name is Tashonda Williamson. It's my birthday month, so I'm a little extra with my yard.
It's nice.
I am a case manager with the Power Program at the Link, and I am a member of the council and very, very elated to be here. So thank you, Chair, Representatives Committee, and then thank you, Representative Moran. I just want to make mention that I have a history, a vast history, in showing up for people in vulnerable situations. And being a part of the council has been very, very special to me in regards to the fact that DHS looks to get our insight and present their proposals and what they're going forth in regards to the community and how it impacts. And so being able to have that voice and show that additional lens is very, very important, and being able to no longer have a sunset. I understand there's different terminology in regards to how we would establish when disparities are no longer present, but being able to have this voice, being able to make sure that lens is being seen and respected, is a great value to this community and society at large.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Williamson. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with the testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Vajong Moore, and I'm the Director of Health Equity Advocacy and Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota. I'm also privileged to be the preceding chair of the Cultural and Ethnic Communities Leadership Council for 5 years as well. And I'm confident that at the end of my career, it will be the hallmark of my career as well. I wanted to just scale up the conversation and then zoom into the significance of this bill. I just want to remind this group that we have some of the worst racial inequities in the country, and that cuts across education, health, employment, housing. And so the significance of this bill and this council is really trying to get at the core of those root causes and long-term solutions, which we know are structural, and that the inequities are in leadership and in inequities in engaging communities of color and indigenous communities. And so what this council does is it makes sure that the engagement of those communities isn't a token gesture, that we are systematizing the engagement of communities who are experiencing the inequities, right? And we're making sure that it is embedded in the way the Department of Human Services operates. We're making sure that equity isn't treated as an amenity, that it is on par with efficiency and effectiveness, that it is central to the mission of DHS. Lastly, I just want to wrap up my testimony by saying that what this refresh bill does is it makes sure that the engagement of the council is authentic and systematized beyond the commissioner and all levels of the organization. I would be a poor partner to other state agencies if I didn't talk about how this council is actually riffing and helping other state agencies like MDH take on equity as well. I urge you to support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 771? Okay. Well, welcome to the committee. Can somebody could either give up their chair, so it might be good. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Reverend Dr. Jean Lee. I head Children's Hope International, which is Legal Advocacy and Policy Group, founded R&R Family Centers, which is the first Asian shelter in Minnesota, which does shelter, housing, and services, including health and human services, and APAC, the Housing Consortium, which includes all the API organizations and that does social services and health care. We first want to thank Representative Moran, who had the vision and hard work to help children, families, seniors, disabled, and others in the communities. She put in many long hours and hard work to do what's best for them. We also want to thank Representative Lee and the other co-authors and the commissioners and their staff and other staff in DHS who have supported the council since its inception. The council was created to be a community-led liaison in providing their cultural and ethnic communities equity, parity, and removing the barriers and services provided by the Department of Human Services, including County Human Services, and to be a mechanism for ensuring transparency and accountability of human services. Statewide cultural and ethnic communities, tribes, and others have the professional knowledge and experience that are important in this partnership with DHS so that they can have an effective and efficient infrastructure, structural equity, and appropriate services important to their clients' social determinants of health. There's a need to strengthen equity, diversity, and inclusion within DHS services and their involvement with the children, families, seniors, and others that they serve. And so there's a sense of urgency to move forward with this council and get work done. So we urge your support of House File 771 with the amendments needed. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Reverend Dr. Lee. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 771? Okay. Seeing none, is there any member discussion? Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And has the council looked at how pharmacogenomics and other new technologies can help get rid of some of the discrepancies and gaps between ethnic health care?
Mr. Moore.
Can you repeat the question, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Yeah.
Representative Kwong.
Basically, the bill is trying to increase the amount of impact the council can have with DHS.
Yeah.
And on medical topics, pharmacogenomics and other newer technologies allow for covering some of the gaps, such a good example is the most prevalent anticoagulant given after a stent is put in is not effective with Native Hawaiians.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other instances of where selecting the right medication and dosage varies from what genetic makeup a person has. And so if this council is going to make direct and influential impact into DHS and decrease these discrepancies, have they looked at this and other related new approaches?
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Moore.
Representative, the crux of this council has focused on the upstream social determinants of health. We know that only 10% of what creates health happens within direct medical care, and then genetics is just another 10% as well. And so the focus has been really far upstream in essentially the entire scope of DHS's work. And it's not to discount or minimize the importance of equitable treatments and technology improvements, but the council is charged to look at systemic issues and has not focused on this single issue. But I think that will be duly noted and can be brought to the attention of the council.
Sure. And Mr. Moore, I mean, just looking at the language of the bill on line 3.27, the existing duties include having the DHS commissioner look at operational decisions and practices that impact racial, ethnic, cultural, linguistic, and tribal disparities, advance legislative proposals to improve racial and health equity outcomes. I mean, so I suppose to the extent the commission identifies that something like the stent Representative Quam described is not being provided in equitable fashion, I suppose it certainly would be within the authority of the council to look into that.
Absolutely.
Okay. Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The point being that I assume the council's been around for a number of years. The gap, we keep telling, is getting worse. And so if we're going to solve these gaps, whether it's healthcare, education, et cetera, we got to look at what policies, procedures, implementations would help level out the gap. And by augmenting with some of the new approaches, whether it's adaptive testing and education, or whether it's new areas of science, that can decrease the gap because, you know, healthcare delivery, you need to be up to date, and you're asking in this bill to expand the influence of this council, and I'm trying to understand the background of the council and how increasing that influence will be more effective in addressing the increasing, increasing gap. And that's why I'm trying to understand what wonderful new approach or activity this bill will help initiate to as a solution.
Thank you, Representative Long. Is there any additional member discussion on House File 771? Okay, seeing none, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 771, as amended, be referred to the HHS Finance Division. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Moran. So just so members are aware, too, we are our scheduled adjourn time is 11:15, but I believe we will go past that on Thursday. I mentioned that was a possibility. I think there's a chance we could make it through the agenda. We do have the room until 12:30. I think we could make it through the agenda and not have to come back. But in the event we don't, we do have the room reserved at 6. So we will come back then if necessary. But my intention is to attempt to make it through the agenda here before 12:30. So next, Representative Moran, once again, you have House File 3127. I will move that House File 3127 be referred to the HHS Policy Division. And it looks like you also have an amendment.
Yes.
The A2 amendment. So I will move the A2 amendment. Does this just put the bill in the shape you would like, or is there anything you'd like to say about it?
Yes. So the amendment that I would like to have adopted is an updated based on the feedback from another, from the work group, the group working on the task force. So the bill creates a task force that will make recommendations for expanding the rights to court-appointed counsels to all eligible parents, guardians, and custodians in all child protection proceedings where a child is at risk of imminent removal from the child's home or has been removed. Stakeholders suggest changes, and those are reflected in their amendments. Minnesota is one of seven states that doesn't require parent representation in child welfare cases. If a child is removed from the home, it is usually not until the first hearing. That parent learned that the allegations are against them. This comes at a time when parents are frightened and emotional. During the first hearing, judges decide if the removal are constitutional, whether the child or children will live until the matter is resolved, and how often the child gets to see their parents. Attorneys assure the law is evenly applied. It protects their clients from unjust accusations and assists in creating visitation and case plans. Without an attorney, we risk unnecessarily separating families and traumatizing children. Each county decides how it will handle public appointments of an attorney. In some counties, there are always attorney presence, but for some, there is never an attorney available. And I'm just going to stop there because with the time that we have before us, just to say that you know, in a county like Ramsey County, we have 80% representation. In Hennepin County, there's a big representation of legal representation. But in the rural communities, and more in most of those rural communities where we are lacking that parental, that legal representation. So I ask that instead of, so we're trying to work through that with the different counties across the state of Minnesota, what that needs to look like. And so instead of having that bill that came before the other committee that says we need to have parent representation, we want to create a task force to kind of like talk through those disagreements around the counties, with the counties around the state.
Thank you, Chair Moran. So we have the A2 amendment before us. Is there any additional discussion to the amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. The bill's in the shape you would like. We'll go to testimony. Whoever would like to go first, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, members of the committee. I'm so happy to be here today with Representative Moran to speak on behalf of this important bill. My name is Natalie Netzel, and I'm the Director of Advocacy and Education with the Institute to Transform Child Protection at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law, where I am a clinical professor. I run a law clinic where we represent parents in child welfare cases in several counties across Minnesota, and we also work nationally to advocate for parent representation, funding, and reform. Through this work, we have seen from the front lines the problems that occur when parents do not receive representation and the immense benefits to children and families that occur when parents are adequately represented. In the spring of 2019, we convened a working group to address this issue with many stakeholders, parent attorneys, county attorneys, social service agency workers, community advocates, the Department of Human Services, and judges. We came together to discuss the urgent need for this bill that we ultimately hope the legislature will adopt. And while we reached consensus on the dire need in Minnesota on this issue, and the time is always right to do the right thing, as we've gone through this process, we're understanding that there are challenges that stakeholders may face in the implementation of right to counsel, and we recognize the need for stakeholders to come together for a successful implementation of this critical need. And otherwise, I'm just happy to answer any questions anyone might have.
Representative Moran, is you going to have additional testimony?
My name is Sarah Erickson. I'm here on behalf of William Mitchell. I'm just here to answer questions. No testimony.
Is there anyone else that wants to testify to this bill?
Mr. Chair, representatives, I'm Reverend Dr. Jean Lee. You know my background. I just wanted to say that back in the 90s, there was a real need for this type of legislation and protection of children and representation by attorneys. There started out the Children's Law Center with the support of many judges and attorneys in law schools. So I'm sure you have their whole support because this is needed. So we urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Any other testimony? Any members of the committee that have questions? Mm-hmm. Representative Plum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, looking through the materials, it opens up the question. There's a great deal of parental differences culturally, and there are a lot of cultural differences across the countries in Asia, Africa, you know, and so competency in bringing those cultural differences in, you know, some of those are based off of, in some cultures, there are certain religious things that the parents, you know, believe in. And that might be different than what the you know agency that feels they would take out, you know, the children from that household. Can you touch upon how this might impact, you know, the protection of those cultural or religious beliefs by the parents?
Chair Moran.
Chair Freiberg, Representative Plum. So Representative Kwan, what the bill does is that within a child protection system, when there's a report moved, is reported, and a child needs to be removed from their home, they have the parent have to show up at court. And so what the bill does, well, what this does is create a task force. But what we're saying needs to happen is that regardless of race and ethnicity or cultural religious belief, a parent should have legal representation with them in court.
Okay. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's currently no avenue for legal representation for the parents in court?
Ms. Erickson.
Sarah Erickson, Representative Kwan. About 10 years ago, there was a court case between the state of Minnesota and and the public defenders. When we went through the last budget crunch, they won that case because they were at the time doing all the representation in these cases. The Supreme Court said that they have no legal obligation to do it because it's a civil case. So right now, parents who are indigenous or not indigenous, excuse me, but qualify financially for representation in some counties often aren't getting it. So the purpose of this task force is to bring all of the stakeholders across the state together to make sure that all parents get the same representation regardless of where they live.
And Chair Fiber and Representative Kwan, as I stated earlier in my presentation, in my county, in Ramsey County, I hear that 80% of the parents who are in child protection cases go before the court are getting legal representation. And we have a high number of parents are getting legal representation in Hennepin County also. What we're not seeing is that representation more out in the rural communities.
Representative Klum?
Thank you. So I'm a little confused why, if you already have good systems in the core metro, and there's more of a need to look at implementing something in the greater area, why you have two members that are from the core 7 county metro and one from outside the 77 county metro area if we need to look at, you know, greater Minnesota to a greater effect. And there are a lot of differences between the areas of greater Minnesota. Why you're biasing appointment? I would think you'd want two from greater Minnesota so you could have one from maybe a regional center and one from a much more sparsely populated area.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Erickson?
Chair Freiberg, Representative Kwan, I guess what I would say is that geography is only stipulated in those two. And there's nothing saying that any other appointment couldn't be from greater Minnesota. I think to Representative Moran's point, even though Hennepin County decides to pay for and chooses to represent parents and Ramsey County does to a lesser extent, we still have Anoka and Washington and Scott County, and there's challenges across the entire state, and we wanted to make sure that there were voices representing it. So that's why we made sure that if there were appointments, that there was at least one from greater Minnesota and one from the metro area.
Representative
Kwan? Thank you, Mr. Chair. And William Mitchell, I had participated in a couple of meetings with a group working on for foster care. Mm-hmm. And I would think that this task force maybe would be better if it included someone familiar with the foster care system, because then you have a global understanding of the system. And that might avoid unintended consequences with what comes out of here. So I'm not the greatest fan of let's get a committee together and come up with ideas, but if we're gonna do that and have a task force or council, I would like to see a little better balancing so that we can understand the differences across the state, and then also more globally at the table, having people that understand the viewpoints around the system instead of just coming at it with one way. because oftentimes we do something out of a great, wonderful idea in our heart, and unintended consequences cause issues. So good luck, and I'd hope that maybe the bill could be in a better form before it reaches the floor.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Is there any additional member discussion to House File 3127? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Moran?
Yes, Chair Fiber, Representative Quam, it is going to be a statewide task force with many stakeholders. There's many key partners that we have to bring together, all who are have knowledge and information about the child welfare system. I definitely would like to have a moment to talk with you to just give you more insight about specifically what we're doing, why we're doing it, and why it's important. And I just ask the committee for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Moran. I will renew my motion that House File 3127, as amended, be referred to the HHS Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Brand, are you here? Okay.
I'm ready to
go. Okay. All right. Representative Hewitt, we'll go with you. We have House File 4171. I will move House File 4171 be referred to the HHS Policy Committee. Welcome to the committee, Representative Hewitt. Please present your bill.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House File 4171 is a project I worked on all summer. I'm going to turn it over to my testifier to tell you what led to us doing this project, and then I'll come back and summarize unless we have other testifiers. But I have Chief Lewis with me from the Virginia Fire Department.
Okay, I have an amendment.
I'm sorry.
Looks like it might be yours. Would you like me to move it?
I would.
Okay, I have the A1 amendment. It looks fairly technical. It does add one member to the board. Is there any discussion? Or would you like to say anything?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it also deletes a good portion of the bill. We're going to move the education stuff separately. So this just basically is the task force adding one member from the MSRB.
Okay, thank you. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment carries. So welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair and members. My name is Chief Alan Lewis of the Virginia Fire Department. I come to you today to talk about an issue that's very, very dear to my heart, and that is the one with emergency medical responses in northern St. Louis County. So I come from the outside of greater Minnesota, moved there, and then noticed that there is really, really a lack of efficient, effective, and timely delivery of EMS care. What we're noticing is in our first responder groups, I'll give you an example, in the month of February, for a look back, 50% of the time a first responder group was called, EMRs, they did not respond. Now the ambulance, of which we cover 640 square miles, did respond, but when you're arriving at patient side, 17, 20, 22 minutes, and no medical care has been given in that intervening time, significant damage can occur. Also, last year in northern St. Louis County, 28 times an ambulance was called, and the primary ambulance that was called to a scene did not respond. This was not because they were out on another call. This was because there were no members available. 28 times an ambulance that was called did not respond. Sometimes it went to a secondary ambulance who did respond. Sometimes it went to a tertiary ambulance. In one case, there was a 46-minute delay for a patient getting an ambulance. In another case, there was a 56-minute delay. Now, when you have a patient that has severe respiratory distress and the secondary ambulance does not respond and the third ambulance does not respond and they receive care 46 minutes later, that is a significant detriment to that patient. There is no qualitative outcomes that we have to actually measure the patient care that is being delivered right now. But what we have is a fractured, ineffective, inefficient, and non-timely delivery of emergency medical care in our area. I believe that this bill is a first step in addressing those concerns. There will be tweaks, I'm sure, as more stakeholders are involved, but we need to take a serious look at EMS care delivery in greater Minnesota. I'm not the only one that faces this challenge. I'm just the one that is able to present here to you today.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for your patience during the hearing, I should mention, and thank you for coming down to St. Paul. I appreciate you being here. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 4171?
Yes, Chair.
Okay, sure. Please step forward. Yeah, you can go next, then you can go. So.
Dr. Conover.
Oh. Yeah. Sure. Dr. Lee, you can please identify yourself for the.
Yes, I'm Reverend Dr. Lee, and you know who I represent. I just wanted to say that we support this House File 4171. Also, when the Representative Quam was talking about the technology, there's new technology coming out where they are making ambulances like mobile operating rooms. And this is really essential, especially for those living in rural areas. And it makes a difference as far as life and death. I had two relatives die, including my father, just because there wasn't enough, equipment and trained people there at the time of need. So this is really important, and we urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Reverend Dr. Lee. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself. And
thank you, Chair, committee members. My name is Andrew Stevens. I'm an emergency medicine physician. I'm also a subspecialty board-certified physician in emergency medical services. What does that mean? That means that EMS essentially represents emergency care outside of hospitals. And in our state, the lead agency for this is the EMSRB, with the oversight and really the consultation of almost 20 physicians from all over the state that represent pre-hospital emergency care. We had our MDSAC, or our advisory committee meeting, last Friday. This bill came up as part of our legislative and advocacy efforts. And as it was written, we are excited for Representative Hewitt and a new voice in EMS and a new engagement and a new way of thinking about this with funding. Unfortunately, at that meeting, we had to have unanimous non-support of this. As you saw, an amendment was before you, and that might not come far enough. The pre-hospital direction and emergency care in this state should be overseen by physicians. And there was a concern that as this task force was set up, that the state medical director, which is a volunteer position, as is all 19 other physicians on the MDSAC, work hard to represent the state and were left off as committee members or as task force members. I also will point out, as will my colleague here from Eagan Fire Department, Chief Scott, that the pre-hospital delivery of emergency care in the state is multidiscipline. And the problems that Virginia have are not unique to Virginia. Actually, we had a great conversation out in the hallway for 20 minutes. He said, our problems sound a lot more alike than different. I said, that's how the world works. And that's what this task force should take on. EMS can be delivered by private agencies. For example, up in Pelican Rapids in Otter Tail County, if it was not for a for-profit ambulance service that every day goes into business, there would be a lack of an ambulance there. There is no representation from the Minnesota Ambulance Association that represents some of those members on this committee, and I would look forward to working with Representative Hewitt to make sure that that representation is there. I'm also the medical director for the city of Eagan and sitting next to my fire chief, and when I looked at this, fire departments provide EMS. Police departments provide EMS. A lot of medical care is done by providers other than doctors, paramedics, and EMTs in this state. And that is really important because Minnesota is a big state with ultra-rural to ultra-urban. And I would support probably that a fire department or the fire-based EMS needs to be supported on this. I hope you appreciate my input, and I'm happy to take any questions at this point.
Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Stevens. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Mike Scott. I'm the Eagan Fire Chief. Today I'm here representing the Minnesota Fire Association Coalition, which is the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association, the Fire Department Association, the Fire Marshals Association, and the Fire Arson Investigators. It's a lot of fire. On behalf of the fire service leaders in Minnesota, we applaud you for recognizing the need to reform the EMS legislation. We believe the current legislation is not currently serving the citizens of Minnesota as well as other systems around the country. This bill, this task force bill, establishes many positive programs that we are concerned about and we've been trying to address for a while. The only thing that we would ask, we're happy to hear the EMSRB board has been added as a representative. We'd like to see fire representative and city representative on this task force. Like Dr. Stevens mentioned, fire departments make up a good part of the EMS response across our state. When something happens in my community, whether it's a private ambulance or the fire service, citizens come to me and ask questions. They assume the ambulance is connected with the city or the fire department. So we'd ask your consideration in defining the representation on the task force as the provision of the EMS in Minnesota as many stakeholders. We want to ensure that everyone is represented. I thank you for your time and let me testify this morning.
Yep. Thank you for your testimony, Chief Scott. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 4171? Okay. Seeing none, any member discussion? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And having been a former member of the EMSRB and having almost all of my immediate family have been first responders or with a volunteer ambulance service. In my district, I understand a lot of the issues and concerns. I am troubled that we don't have a Senate companion bill. I was hoping we'd be able to find someone, for that. And I'm also troubled that out of 11 members, the governor appoints 7. And there's no delineation, and frankly, I do think we need some representation from greater Minnesota and some of the volunteer organizations, fire department, police. There are also first responders that, have a different breakdown of their scope. And in order to find a solution for Minnesota, we really need to have whoever gets together, they've got to be able to have the full view of what things are like in Minnesota. Touch on technology. There's some great possibilities. We did some improvements with community paramedic, but, there's a lot of ways to go. I like the intent. I do have some heartburn with the implementation. And in order to be successful, we really would probably need to have, a broader group at the table and include it on the board. Thank you.
Sure, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Quam, we put this bill together pretty quick because you were at one of the meetings. You knew what I went through, the 8 locations I visited throughout the state. By plane, boat, and air, basically everywhere I went this state year. And that story you heard from Chief Allen Lewis is not different from your own area. You know what we're going up against. The deal is the system is working to a 1970 structure right now. It's not working to a 2000-plus structure. And that's what you're not hearing, and that's why we need to get this going as soon as possible. Now, am I open to other stakeholders? Definitely, but I had to move the bill. And that's where it is. And we do have a Senate author. Senator Lang is going to take the bill. It was introduced, and it is being pushed forward. So we do. It's just that we just got the jackets, literally, and I had to beg the chair for a meeting. So we need to see this happen, especially in the current space we are right now. We need to have a very robust EMS system in the state, and we need to move it forward. Right now, we have ambulances that don't roll at night. In fact, we talked about them in your own session there. We have people that are so burnt out they can't go. And we need to address that, and that's pretty much rural Minnesota. We have other problems in the local Twin Cities here that our EMS board's trying to deal with, but right now the capacity's not there of what we call our primary service areas. So we're at a very ripe time to do something like this. It's unfortunate we didn't do this before we put the board together. I was actually a part of that, and we didn't put a task force together then to see exactly what we needed. That board is about 19 people, and it's really hard to be effective there. And when I announced this board, I had everybody from fire chiefs, mental health workers, community nurses, teachers wanting to be on this board. And so I thought the best thing to do was get the basics going and move forward. So I am really open to working with these groups and getting the right people on it. We just need to keep going. Mr. Chair, sorry.
Sure. That's okay. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Okay. Any additional member discussion on House File 4171? Oh, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. And I'll be brief. I just wanted to thank you, Representative Hewitt, for bringing this forward. I know that
My father and grandfather were all part of Bloomington Rescue Squad back in the day, and I know that there's been a considerable amount of change in the landscape since the 70s when they were doing that. And I do think that this is a timely bill in order to kind of get us up to snuff on where we should be in terms of making sure that we're providing the best patient care in the most timely manner. I really appreciate that, and I also appreciate your flexibility on working with stakeholders about making sure that we have the right folks at the table. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Any additional member discussion? Seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Hewitt?
Mr. Chair and members, I really appreciate you looking at this bill today, and it really does. This is what Minnesota is about. These are our values. We want to make sure when someone calls 911, the right person gets there and they can help our people. So I encourage you to move this bill forward, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 4171, as amended, be referred to the HHS Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? The motion carries. If you're wondering why I'm talking slowly, it's because I'm waiting to see if a chief author walks in the door. Yeah. Okay, I know there's a member apparently on their way down. Yeah, all right, Representative Salk, how about we just do yours?
Sure.
So, House File 3483. Representative Salk moves that House File 3483 be referred to the General Register.
It was fortuitous that I figured out that I did not need a big cadre of people to talk to you about this. Most of you have actually heard this particular bill at an earlier meeting. And so, in general, I'll just outline what's taking place. The Charter Commission, which is the ruling body of policy in Rochester, has found itself to be inefficient under its current dates and times, that sort of thing. So the issue is that the current structure is that the chief judge appoints any members that have vacated their position, whether it would be because of illness, because they've moved out of the area, or been removed. I guess technically that would be another way that would have happened. So when there is an opening in then the court meets, or the chief judge decides through a process that they're satisfied with to appoint the successor. They do that appointment in 30 days, and when that doesn't happen under current law, then it rolls back to the city itself, the city council. The Rochester Council has analyzed the process in general, and that was one of the elements that they felt is probably not in the best interest of good order. So what they have done is they have, in this bill, it moves the timeline for the judge to 60 days, at which time the chief judge has told us that that is plenty of time for them to get that appointment made to collect together, whether it's to find the people of the candidates and that sort of thing, but they can get it done. So that was one of the questions was, well, what happens if it doesn't happen? The chief judge said that they are under very strict supervision in the court, and that if one of them as a chief judge failed to get that done in 60 days, that would be considered a sort of a breach of their duty relative to their supervising judge. And so she believed that, and in our case, it's a lady that is the chief judge. She believed that there would be no chance for them to go past the 60 days, that the law itself would be motivation enough, plus the supervision, so that they will comply with that as they go through it. So, in essence, that's the nature of the change in the bill. There's also the removal, then, of the circle back with the appointment. If it's not made by the judge, that it would circle back to the city council. That has been removed from the language. So really those are the two elements in this particular bill that have been offered, and I guess you can ask any questions if you feel necessary. Oh, I do know one other thing that is maybe of interest to some of you. The League of Minnesota Cities did an analysis of this by sending it out to all of its members. They received one feedback comment. That comment was noting the fact that it had been, that circleback had been removed. They did not object. They did not, and everybody else just accepted the change as being appropriate for operation. So not only did members get to talk that have charter systems, but even the other league members saw the change and were able to make comments if there were and there were none. So at this point, it looks like it has been agreed to and or approved by the participant cities.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Salk. Is there anyone who would like to testify regarding House File 3483? Okay. Seeing none, any member discussion? Seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Salk? Okay. Thank you. Representative Salk renews his motion that House File 3483 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Salk. Representative Morrison, you have House File 1400. I will move that House File 1400 be referred to the Judiciary Committee, and it looks like you have an amendment. Would you like me to move that as well?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I will move the A3 amendment. Is this just put the bill in the shape you would like, or?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any discussion to the amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Morrison, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1400 establishes a spoken language health care interpreter registry to be administered by the Commissioner of Health. This bill is the result of years of ongoing stakeholder engagement efforts, including providers, health plans, patients, limited English proficient communities, clinicians, interpreting agencies, interpreter member organizations, and independent interpreters. We've been committed to ensuring that all these stakeholders have their voices heard in the process. This legislation does not just impact interpreters, it also serves to protect the Medicaid recipient patients who do not speak English and rely solely on medical interpreters from the moment they check into the emergency room until they are discharged. These are some of the most vulnerable patient populations within our healthcare system and require our action as legislators to ensure that they have equitable access to care of the same quality that those of us who speak English as our native language are provided. We must take urgent action on this legislation. Every day we do not move forward with a verified registry system, we put those patients' lives at risk. This bill establishes three categories of interpreter competency, which represent the minimum standard within the field: core, proficient, and certified. The key provisions in the bill features significant changes to the language from previous versions of the bill brought before this committee. Stakeholders have made substantial strides in reaching an agreement. It has bipartisan support in both the House and Senate. It requires the formation of an advisory council with membership representing a broad group of stakeholders, including patient representatives, interpreters, providers, and metro and rural representation. It also calls for a public-private task force to identify ongoing scholarship funds for training and testing and to oversee an MDH-DHS study on creating stratified reimbursement for interpreters based on training and competency. Establishment of procedures for receiving and investigating complaints about identified prohibitive conduct and for imposing disciplinary or corrective action as needed. It also provides interpreters with due process protections against false complaints. Registration is not mandatory for all interpreters in Minnesota, only for those who wish to be eligible for Medicaid reimbursement. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifier, Anjali Cameron.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for considering the amended language before you. For the record, my name is Anjali Cameron, and I'm Research Director at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. Along with my colleague, Rosa Talk, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs, our agencies have been working on addressing barriers experienced by our respective constituencies. In the last 2 years, Ms. Talk and I have spoken to over 100 interpreters, presented at interpreter and health industry conferences throughout the state regarding this legislation, and collected additional feedback from LEP populations. Based on all the responses and feedback we received, we put together the language you see before you, based initially on a 2015 Department of Health report to the legislature. The language is the result of compromises between a spectrum of interpreters and patients for whom the roster system is not currently working. The language relevant to this committee can be found in Section 6 on page 9 of the bill before you. The bill creates a much-needed interpreter advisory council made up of 17 members. The membership includes interpreters, limited English proficient patient representatives, interpreter agencies, healthcare providers, and payers, amongst others. The membership aims to balance the representation between the 7-county metro area as well as greater Minnesota. The duties of the advisory council are extensive and are on pages 10 and 11, and they include providing guidance to the Department of Health on the rollout of this registry system. Some of these primary responsibilities include developing the core interpreter exam content, identifying and training continuing education opportunities, evaluating costs and any fees associated with the registry system, identifying gaps in interpreter services in rural areas or for uncommon languages, and finally, identifying barriers to entry in the registry system and the overall field of interpreting. In addition, the Commissioner of Health and Commissioner of Human Services, along with the new advisory council, will make recommendations back to the legislature regarding a stratified medical assistance reimbursement system corresponding to the established training categories for interpreters. The amended language, as Representative Morrison mentioned before you, increases the number of interpreters serving on the advisory council from 3 to 6. This change is the result of direct stakeholder engagement during the summer of 2019, during which interpreters, including the largest interpreter member organization, UMSHA, or the Upper Midwest and Interpreter Translator Association, made a specific request for this change. Between our two councils, we have held meetings and reached out to partner organizations, agencies, providers, and interpreters across the state of Minnesota, including but not limited to St. Cloud, Marshall, Wilmer, Appleton, Rochester, the Northfield Faribault area, and of course the Twin Cities Metro. We have a diverse coalition from both public and private sector agencies who see this legislation in its amended form as a necessary step in the right direction. Our agency continues to work with these stakeholders, the Department of Health, and others to ensure that we are making meaningful improvements in the quality of care provided to all communities in Minnesota, including our limited English proficient populations. I'm happy to answer any questions regarding the bill language from committee members.
Thank you, Ms. Cameron. Just so members are aware, too, the version that was in your packet was the version as introduced. There is a first engrossment that was handed out to you, so you should have the updated version in front of you. Thank you, Ms. Cameron. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 1400? Okay. Welcome back to the committee. Reverend Dr. Lee, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Reverend Dr. Lee. I just wanted to say that, again, our organizations come out in support of House File 1400. I was part of the original work with the Supreme Court Racial Bias Task Force when they established court interpreters, registry, and certifications. And there was a need discussed at that time as far as doing it separately for the healthcare system because of the difference in some of the terminologies and what was going on there. At that time, I believe they only had Russian, Vietnamese, and Spanish being used in the healthcare system. And in Hennepin County alone, there's over 159 languages spoken there. It's always had the support of the councils of color, and we support our Asian council in this effort, and we urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Reverend Dr. Lee. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 1400? Okay, seeing none, we'll go to member discussion. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. We definitely have a lot of languages spoken, particularly in this area. And I'm assuming that if somebody comes to emergency room, the care goes on until the interpreter gets there. So, how would I put it? Or does it? I guess my question is, it's got to be, if it's an emergency, how is interpreting taken care of? And knowing that certain religious practices would make things a little bit difficult if if the person was able to talk. So it sounds like you understand the question I'm trying to get to.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. It's an important one, and I don't know that the bill addresses it, but I can speak to it somewhat from my own experience as a healthcare provider in a hospital. I think in our community, we do the best job that we can to have an interpreter present immediately upon arriving in a hospital, but there are circumstances where an emergency call for immediate decision-making, which is suboptimal. So the ideal scenario is that that interpreter is in place. So often if someone is coming by ambulance, there's a little bit of lead time to make sure that we can get someone in place who can describe what's going on so that the patient can have the care that they deserve and true informed consent.
Yeah. Representative Mason.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, having in my area the latest ranking has it as the number one hospital in the world. They've got millions of visitors. And there are quite a few languages spoken there. So I understand the intent behind the bill. At some point, you do cover the remote translation. At some point, I anticipate seeing a grant for the U of M for a universal translator system. But I didn't see in this newest engrossment that we received a few minutes ago anything about nonverbal interpreters.
Ms. Cameron?
So I'll try to address that question, although I will admit that any advancements in artificial intelligence are outside of my area of expertise. However, this bill does address video relay interpreting, something that interpreting agencies within the state of Minnesota are developing on their own. And so it does require that anyone who uses video relay interpreting be subject to the registry system and meet the minimum standards required. However, any further advancements in technology, this bill doesn't touch.
Okay. Representative Quam?
Thank you. The question I had was, just the moments I've had the current version of the bill, I did not locate nonverbal interpreters. And I think that's a fairly, it's not just an interpreter that can do sign language, an interpreter that can understand maybe some multiple languages. If you can elaborate how you're addressing that.
Representative Morrison, I saw you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, this bill is explicitly for spoken language interpreting.
Okay, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And frankly, there's a large portion of the population that then isn't being addressed. And if you're going to go to a registry and we're going to generate all this activity, it would behoove us to not exclude such a significant portion and just leave them out. So I would hope that could be addressed along the path that this bill goes, because I think that is, I guess, critical, at least to the people that, need it.
Thank you, Representative Quam. I'm sure there is a whole separate section of statute dealing with requirements for American Sign Language and so forth. I mean, we're getting a little bit outside of government operations, but Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's specifically to this, because the discussion is there's no reimbursement for interpretive services, and some of the federal programs was brought up in testimony, and so we're doing a register for interpreters. And if you've got, it directly goes to it. I think it's just left out, so that if we're going to do a register, let's include that large group in with the register.
Sure.
That was the point.
Thank you, Representative Quam. We do have two additional bills here. Both authors are now here. I would like to get to them before we have to adjourn at 12:30. Otherwise, we may need to come back this evening. So appreciate the comment, Representative Quam. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be brief. First, I want to say thank you to Representative Morrison. Thank you to Anjali and to Reverend Dr. Lee for being here and shining a light on this issue and how incredibly important it really is. I can tell you my mother has worked at Hennepin County Medical Center for 43 years as a nurse, the first probably 20 of that in emergency room and urgent care. And I can't tell you how many times she came home concerned that they could not find an adequate interpreter. And I'll give you a very brief example of how this plays out. And while this sample might sound slightly comical to us, it would make perfect sense. A young immigrant family came into the emergency room with a child who had a terrible earache, really, really bad, in terrible pain, just crying and crying and crying. And so the physician, they couldn't find an available interpreter at the time, but they wrote a script for an oral antibiotic to try and address the ear pain. And they went home, and 3 days later, they returned again, the child even worse off than before, screaming and crying, and they could not understand why the medicine was not working. And a very quick scope of the child's ear revealed that these new immigrant parents, thinking it was for an earache, actually put the medicine in the child's ear rather than taking it orally. And while it seems silly to us, and it seems obvious to us that that should have been an oral medication, for new parents, that really wasn't obvious. And in this case, this poor little one had to suffer for 3 more days in terrible pain. And imagine the agony of those parents trying to take care of this child as well. But it underscores the really valid importance of this bill and why it's absolutely 100% necessary. So thank you to you all for being here. And I know there was a lot of work that went into this. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Any additional member discussion? Okay, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1400 be referred to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Brand, we have...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, thank you, Representative Morrison. Representative Brand has House File 3928. I will move that House File 3928 be referred to the General Register. Welcome to the committee. Representative Brand, please describe your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 3928 addresses a couple of things. The Rural Health Advisory Committee, in which I serve, is a statutorily established body, and what we're asking for is an expansion of the amount of members and who those members represent in Minnesota and the health advisory field. In addition, a specific requirement for a member who works with people with mental illness. And the bill also removes that the requirement for the consumer member group and clarifies that one of the consumer members is from a community experiencing health disparities or is an advocate for people who with developmental disabilities. It also has updates language for the mid-level practitioner to advanced practice professional. And that's for the Rural Health Advisory Committee. The e-health advisory committee, one of the things is to repeal the sunset on that particular committee itself. The advisory committee has been an important forum for discussing, providing input for proposing federal rules and for emerging topics such as e-health to address the opioid epidemic and engaging patients in their care, especially in my neck of the woods, being a representative of the rural area of Minnesota. This proposal also represents adds a representative from tribal reservations to membership. Several other state agencies already hold seats on that advisory committee, such as the Department of Health, Commerce, and Administration. Under this proposal, these agencies would continue to perform this function. Rather, another one that's interesting about this bill is it actually creates an advisory council on water supply. The state has administered a formal stakeholder body for water and wastewater certification since 1971, but reinstating this council will create an inclusive leadership team that is representative of the following stakeholders to advise Minnesota Department of Health and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And that would be water supply and wastewater facility operators, municipalities, state, general public, metro, and outstate representation. Both MDH and MPCA have agreed that there is a legitimate need for a formal advisory committee to serve as an external review of governance on water supply and wastewater treatment programs across our state. and the citizens of the state will have the reassurance that rules and actions pertaining to the public water supply system and wastewater treatment systems are being advanced not just by state agencies, but with the input of fellow citizens experienced in the field of water and wastewater operations. And then the last part that I wanted to touch base on, I guess, was the HEAL committee. The HEAL was created by Commissioner Illinger in 2017, and the council has been tied to statute, which creates the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative grant program in 2001 and required consultation communities of color and American Indians to advise the grant program itself. The new statute that I'm proposing is being introduced to solidify the performance of the HEAL Council. There are two reasons for that. If the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative program were to end, the council would also end as well. And then also the HEAL's scope of work has been expanded to advise not just the grant program, but the agency as a whole regarding how to embed equity into policies and programs in order to eliminate health disparities at an institutional level. And so that is the overview of my bill. I know there's some specifics in there. You might have some questions as well. And I believe there's also someone that wants to testify from the department.
Okay. Is there anyone who would like to testify on House File 3928?
No. Okay. They don't.
Okay. We do have one testifier.
Perfect.
Reverend Dr. Lee, welcome back. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, I'm Reverend Dr. Lee, and you've heard my background. I just wanted to say that we do support House File 3928, especially the establishment of the council in the Department of Health. I was part of creating the Office of Multicultural and Minority Health at the federal and state level. That evolved into Illinger-created HEAL connected to that, and they went on to create what was called the Health Equity Leadership Network, which I'm a member. I just want to say kudos to Bruce and Sarah, who have demonstrated great and outstanding leadership and talent and have done some really amazing things with this group. They are very well connected to the cultural and disability communities. I believe Representative Quam spoke about access or consideration persons with disabilities, and they also work well with seniors. All of our API partner organizations that does healthcare and services are also, they work very well with them. So, and then also Representative Quam raised the issue as far as some of the health issues and technology, and this would fit more with this particular advisory group. So thank you.
Thank you, Reverend Dr. Lee. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 3928? Seeing none, we'll go to member discussion. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Brand, I'm just interested in this provision on lines 14 or 4.16 to 4.18. And when you said it, it just feels a little discordant to me to say that you're looking for somebody from a community experiencing health disparities or an advocate for persons who have developmental disabilities. Like, those feel like very different things. And to, you know, have an or there, I'm just trying to understand the intent of that.
Representative Brand?
Certainly. And so this, that was an agency amendment that we changed. And so that goes back from the Department of Health. And so maybe they wish to talk about a little bit more about that. That was just something that we had agreed to to the last committee. But
yep. I see a representative coming down. If you could please identify yourself for the record and then proceed with the response.
I'm Zora Radosovich, the Director of the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care in the Minnesota Department of Health. So, Mr. Chairman, Representative, previously the three consumers required someone be an advocate from the for persons or working with persons who have mental illness, and we're changing the terminology from saying persons who are developmentally disabled to saying have developmental disabilities. And then we wanted to add, not require that, but make that a stated option So it's not restricted to having two members, one who represents people with from communities of health disparities and advocates, or advocates for developmental disabilities. But those are two options that we would encourage people to apply to be serving on the board.
Representative Gomez?
Even given that explanation, it remains strange and discordant to me. I guess that's all I'll say. I'm not sure. I mean, it feels like if you want, that you would maybe have somebody from each of those perspectives, since they bring very different perspectives. So that's good. I'm good, though.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do appreciate the ill at ease that the previous representative about some of the language. This, I wish I had some antacids, because every time, it seems a consistent pattern, dropping sunsets. And I understand we want to have this around, but if we have an autopilot, we no longer are allowing or forcing the members to look at these areas every few years to see, do we need to improve the composition of the board? Do we, or council, or task force, or work group? Do we need to improve the mission or clarify the mission statement? Add in areas that popped up in the last few years? But we go ahead and we drop out sunsets. We put these on autopilot, and we tend not to then give the attention. And the idea of having a sunset is that we are forced to reevaluate every few years, is this working? And I tell you, a lot of the gap issues we have seems like we've been on autopilot for decades, whether it's disparities in healthcare, disparities in education, etc. And it's not fun to go through this battle repeatedly, but I think it is a disservice to throw things onto autopilot and risk not being forced to give it a review and attention. So that's the heartburn on this and many bills we've heard today. It requires work to be in the legislature and do the job right. And I think we're sidestepping a mechanism that forces us to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Any additional member discussion? Okay. Seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Brand?
Thank you for the feedback, and it's a good bill. I hope you support it.
Okay. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3928 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you very much.
Representative Hansen, you have House File 3657. I will move that House File 3657 be referred to the Education Finance Division. Environment Finance, sorry. I saw an E. I've been doing this too many times today. So I will move that House File 3657 be referred to the Environment Finance Division. Please describe your bill, Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 3657 is the DNR policy bill, and it has a number of technical corrections. I believe the reason it is here in front of you are sections 21 and sections 24, special use permits, where the DNR is asking for an exemption from rulemaking. Section 21 allows the DNR to develop reasonable policies for special use permits to use state parks, state recreation areas, and state waysides. And Section 24 allows the DNR to develop reasonable policies for special use permits to use state trails and state water access sites. I have with me Mr. Nick Fronauer to talk about those if anybody has any questions, and I'd ask for your support.
Thank you. Is there anyone who would like to testify on House File 3657? Okay, seeing none, any member discussion? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the section with the special use permits, I do have some concern. It's been a few terms since I've served on the committee, but I have been monitoring some of the activities, and a large portion of the activities the DNR performs is what, a third to 40%, somewhere in there, is funded by dedicated accounts from permit fees and non-general fund sources. And frankly, it'd be nice if you're creating a new, they can come up and they can have special events and raise money through that, understanding where, what accounts it's going to, and then the accountability and what jurisdictions for oversight when you formulate that. Because too often it sort of happens and nobody really notices. And then I also had a little bit of concern over the lessening of legislative oversight on the permanent school fund by decreasing the frequency of report and information coming back. I know that that's been a contentious thing over the years, and I'm not sure we're ready to not give it the oversight that was recently put onto it.
Chair Hansen?
Those are good comments. I think part of the reason why we want to move to less reporting is because a lot of those problems have been resolved rather than in the heat of the battle. And I think the system is operating. As far as the special use permits, Representative Quam, I think we have a topic in front of us, in front of the legislative auditor, looking at those expenditures. It was put forward by a very bright and inquisitive legislator. And so I'm sure that we can look at that deeper there. But these are something that I think is somewhat routine for those events. And it just gives the authority rather than going through the full-blown rulemaking. I think it would actually help efficiency and effectiveness in serving Minnesotans. So I would ask for your support for the bill.
Okay. Any additional member discussion? Okay. Seeing none, it sounds like you made your closing remarks kind of right there. So I will renew my motion that House File 3657 be referred to the Environment Finance Division. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, members. Because of our efficiency here, we do not need to meet this evening. We have completed our agenda. So if there are no questions from members, I will adjourn this meeting.